Okay, good afternoon, everybody. Welcome. To our third Jonathan Charney lecture. Let me just say a few words of introduction. Jonathan Charney taught at Vanderbilt for over 30 years, and in the process, over his career, became one of the world's leading scholars of international law. And he created for Vanderbilt Law School an international law program that was part of Vanderbilt's general ascent from a regional to a world university. And it was only fitting when we decided to create this lectureship, an endowed lectureship, that it was named after Jonathan Charney and became the Jonathan Charney Lecture. This is our third of this series. Anne Marie Slaughter was our introductory lecturer, and then William Chavez was our second. And now our third, we're honored to have Jeremy Waldron, a professor of law at Columbia University. Jeremy was a former colleague of mine at Bald Hall and a friend, but that's not his only qualification. He happens to be one of the world's leading legal philosophers. And I could spend a considerable part of the remaining time recording his academic achievements. Let me just read to you the list of books, and I don't think it's a complete list, but a list of books that he's written: The Right to Private Property, Nonsense Upon Stilts, Bentham, Burke, and Marx on the Rights of Man, Liberal Rights, The Dignity of Legislation, Law and Disagreement, and most recently, God, Locke, and Equality. Jeremy has, in addition to being a very distinguished legal philosopher, is specifically somebody who has been a voice for human rights, and somebody who's written eloquently and spoken eloquently across a whole range of issues, from theoretical considerations of human rights to more specific discussions of issues such as homelessness. And today, of course, he's going to talk about an issue that's very much on people's minds and that really lies at the core of current concerns about human rights, and specifically in the intersection of human rights and international law. So without further ado, it's really a pleasure to introduce Jeremy Waldron.
Thank you, Dean Rubin. It's a great pleasure to be here in Nashville. Carol and I have had terrific hospitality since we arrived, and it's been a wonderful visit. It's a great honor to give the third Jonathan Charney lecture, and I'm afraid I've chosen a topic for this afternoon's discussion that's not a pleasant topic. It's a matter of some shame that we have to devote lectures now to the subject of torture, not as something of historical interest, but as a matter of topical concern. But there it is. It's here, it's with us, and we have to think about it. There are many things to be said. I want to concentrate this afternoon on just one of them: the prospect that the legalization of torture, or the relaxation of the rules that prohibit it, might deal a wider blow to the character of our legal system. That's going to be the general theme, and that's what I mean when I use this term legal archetype, which I will explain as we go along. Now, I talk about the prohibition on torture. Of course, there are several prohibitions on torture. The law relating to torture comprises a variety of provisions. There's the basic provision of human rights law is found in the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. And if you just sort of glance at that, you'll see Article 7 insist that no one shall be subjected to torture or to cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment or punishment. And then if you look at Article 4, there's a provision maybe for some of the rights in the Convention to be modified in times of great public emergency, but there's a specific insistence that this provision for derogation does not apply to the right against torture. The right against torture is, like one or two other rights, established as absolute. You'll know also that besides this general covenant on civil and political rights, we have a specific covenant relating to torture, the Convention Against Torture, which requires states to take effective legislative, administrative, judicial, or other measures to prevent acts of torture in their territory or in any territory under their jurisdiction. And again, you'll see the second part of that article establishes that this requirement is absolute, not to be relaxed in times of public emergency. Besides the International Convention, besides the International Covenant, and besides the Convention Against Torture, we also have the provisions of the Geneva Conventions. And just to quickly put those up pursuant to our requirements under the Torture Convention, we are required to establish laws that specifically prohibit it. And so Section 2340A of the US Code establishes torture as a criminal offense outside the United States. It's assumed that ordinary criminal law handles it within the United States. It's punishable by a serious term of imprisonment or by death if death results from the offense. So we have that statutory provision. We have the Geneva Conventions, the third of which specifically provides no physical or mental torture nor any other form of coercion may be inflicted on prisoners of war. And then if you want to start playing word games with prisoners of war, there is common Article 3, which is held in common to all four of the Geneva Conventions, which emphasizes that persons taking no active part in hostilities, including members of armed forces who have laid down their arms, shall in all circumstances be treated humanely. And it lists the number of acts that are and shall remain prohibited at any time and in any place whatsoever, which includes violence to life and person, mutilation, cruel treatment, and torture, as well as outrages upon personal dignity and humiliating and degrading treatment. Now, together, those rules, international, humanitarian, domestic, add up to a very formidable array of explicit prohibitions on torture. In addition, there are the rules of the Jos Kogan's rules of international law that apply whether anybody has signed up to the Convention Against Torture or not, which establish that torture, like slave trading, like piracy, like terrorism, is an offense against international law quite apart from anybody's particular signature on any particular covenant. The torturer, as one of our judges has put it, and those who authorize torture are treated by law, just like the pirate, the terrorist, and the slave trader, as hostis humani generis, an enemy of all mankind. And then in addition we have, I guess, the provisions of constitutional law and the ordinary criminal law and the specific provisions of military law, all of which add up to an interlocking series of prohibitions, which is what I will have in mind when I talk about the rule against torture, although obviously there are many of them. So that's the law. As you know, as a matter of fact, the United States of America is now widely regarded in the world and also among some of its own citizens as a torture state. That is, as one of a handful of countries that have been willing to countenance and encourage the use of torture, notwithstanding these prohibitions. Whether that is correct or not is a further issue, but that is certainly what is widely believed in the world and among some people in this country. in public life, in our news magazines, for example, there are constant calls for torture to be used to extract information from those suspected of involvement in terrorist activity. Charles Krauthammer's article in the Weekly Standard is the best-known recent example. One of our leading legal scholars, Alan Dershowitz, has publicly called for a system of judicial torture warrants to be used in certain circumstances in the war against terror. Attempts were made in 2002 by lawyers working for the Justice Department in the notorious torture memoranda. There's a sort of the heading of the most notorious of them, the Bybee memorandum, to narrow the meaning of torture, trying in effect to change the word into a technical term that would cover, in law, much less than most ordinary folks would expect, so that it would not, for example, cover repeated beatings in the course of interrogation, or so that it would not cover waterboarding, which is a use of half-drowning, repeated half-drowning, as an interrogation technique. Attempts were also made to establish the principle that no statutory prohibition, including our own anti-torture statute, could be valid constitutionally against the authority of the president as commander-in-chief, or anybody acting under his authority as commander-in-chief. The president, as you know, reaffirmed his right to authorize extreme methods of interrogation even as he signed the recent legislation embodying the McCain Amendment, in which Congress once again purported to prohibit torture and cruel and inhuman and degrading treatment in the course of interrogation. And of course, we have not only these legal attacks on the rules, but there's actually the reality of the use of torture that has happened so far, some of it in Afghanistan, some of it at Guantanamo Bay, some of it at who knows how many secret facilities maintained around the world by us or by our allies on our behalf, and of course the well-publicized descent into depravity at Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. So we have a whole set of prohibitions, and we have a bewildering and in some sense repellent series of calls to use torture and the actual use of these techniques. Some of this, as you know, is being done in our name, but with scant regard to legality, being done in secret, or just being done. People will think about the legalities later. Much of it, however, does involve claims, semi-public claims about legal justification. The torturers are not just taking detainees away for waterboarding, they are attempting to drag the law, our law, along with them. In a recent article in the Columbia Law Review, I argued that there's something shocking jurisprudentially about the defense of torture, something shocking from the point of view of the law's own self-image, about the undermining of the rules against torture. The fact that proposals to justify torture explicitly, or to justify torture in all but name, the fact that those are being voiced by scholars and by jurists who have devoted their lives to the law, some of them holding high positions in legal education, some of them appointed to the higher judiciary, one of them now occupying the position of Attorney General, is, I think, a matter of shame for the legal profession, for the legal academic profession, and for the profession of lawyering in public life. So I want to talk this afternoon about that specifically legal sense of shame. The question I want to ask, if you like, is why does the prospect of legally authorizing torture shock the conscience of a scrupulous lawyer? Is it simply that the unthinkable has become thinkable since September the 11th, 2001? Or is it something about the specific effect on law, perhaps some sort of systemic corrupting effect of this abomination becoming one of the normal items on the menu of practical consideration? Well, in answering this question, I mean, here's what I want to pursue. maybe there are certain things which we can imagine justifying for certain circumstances, but whose legal permissibility, if we did make them permissible, whose legal permissibility would have such an impact on the rest of the law, that this change would have such an impact on the rest of the law, that that in itself would be a strong or conclusive reason for not permitting them. Even if we are prepared to overcome the usual reasons associated with those specific rules that I had up on the screen a moment ago, maybe there is something about the systemic effect on the legal system that might be worth taking into account. There's an analogy that I found helpful in thinking about this. It's an argument from an old English case that those of you who have read Robert Cover's book, Justice Accused, will be familiar with. It's an old case from 1772, Somerset's case. James Somerset was an African slave belonging to a resident of Virginia. This was in colonial times. And Somerset was brought to England by his master in 1769. Somerset made a bid for freedom, ran away, but he was apprehended and detained aboard ship by his master's agents for a voyage to Jamaica, where his master proposed to sell him. A writ of habeas corpus was brought by English abolitionists on Somerset's behalf. And of course, counsel for the master, for the detainers, argued that the English courts were required to recognize Somerset's slave status and required to recognize his master's property rights as a matter of private international law, as a matter of the conflicts of laws. We had to respect slave status in the United States just as we might respect a marriage contracted abroad if somebody comes to English shores. Counsel for the petitioner resisted that, and he opposed it in the argument in the terms that I have up there. He said, shall an attempt be made to introduce perpetual servitude to this island? Remember, Great Britain did not have slavery within Britain itself, even though it was permitted in the colonies. Shall an attempt to introduce perpetual servitude here to this island hope for countenance? The laws, the genius and spirit of the Constitution forbid the approach of slavery, will not suffer its existence here. Our mild and just Constitution is ill-adapted to the reception of arbitrary maxims and practices. Well, the law report reveals that after some hesitation, the judge, Lord Mansfield, agreed with this argument and ordered that Somerset be discharged, saying that the state of slavery is of such a nature that it is incapable of being introduced on any reasons but only by positive law. It is so odious that nothing can be suffered to support it but positive law. What's he saying there? He's not denying that Parliament could pass a law setting up slavery in Great Britain. He's not denying that the sovereign Parliament could do this. And if it did do it, then the English law would just have to put up with the trauma that this would inflict on the rest of their celebrated principles of liberty. The prospect of that trauma, however, motivated what Lord Mansfield wanted to say. The affront to liberty implicit in a person's confinement on the basis that he is another man's chattel is so high an act of dominion that nothing but an explicit enactment could possibly establish it. Bringing it in the back door by the use of principles of private international law and recognition of status from elsewhere is not to be permitted. We would have no truck with it unless we are absolutely forced to by our own legislature. Well, what I have in mind is that something analogous may be true of torture. There is no question but that it could be introduced into our law directly by legislation or indirectly by so narrowing a definition that torture was being authorized in all but name. But its introduction would be contrary to the genius and spirit of our law, for there is in the heritage of Anglo-American law a long tradition of rejecting torture and of regarding it as alien to our jurisprudence. True, there were in England and Tudor and Stuart times torture warrants issued under the First Elizabeth and under James I. They were issued in the exercise of prerogative power. They were never issued under color of actual legal authority. And William Blackstone's comment in the commentaries is quite telling. He observes that that the refusal to authorize torture was an early point of pride for the English judiciary. After the assassination of the Duke of Buckingham, there was a proposal, says Blackstone, in the Privy Council to put the assassin to the rack in order to discover his accomplices. The judges, being consulted, declared unanimously to their own honor and the honor of the English law that no such proceeding was allowable by the laws of England. And until relatively recently, until the signatory of the most notorious of the torture memos was appointed to the Ninth Circuit, the same has been true of the American judiciary. They too have said again and again that the use of torture is utterly incompatible with the spirit of our legal system. Suggested that there have been and are now certain foreign nations with governments which convict individuals with testimony obtained by police organizations possessed of an unrestrained power to seize persons suspected of crimes against the state, hold them in secret custody, and wring from them confessions by physical or mental torture. So long as the Constitution remains the basic law of our republic, America will not have that kind of government. American judges have long been anxious to distance themselves from what they once referred to as the kind of custodial interrogation that was employed by the Star Chamber or by the Germans of the 1930s and early 1940s. Torture in American judicial writing is seen as characteristic not of free, but of tyrannical governments. There was a long tradition of establishing that people at certain foreign ports had to be subject to the jurisdiction of consuls rather than the jurisdiction of the local governments, precisely because, or at least one of the reasons, was that otherwise they might be subject to the torture, which would be forbidden by our own tribunals, but may be permitted in, 19th century Morocco or something like that. So it is said that this may be something that happens elsewhere in the world, but not in a free country, not in a country like ours. Our constitutional arrangements are motivated precisely by the desire to set the face of our law against such ancient evils. So that's the idea that I want to pursue. That's the idea that I'd like to elaborate a little bit. And if you'll bear with me, elaborating it in terms of this notion of archetype is going to require just a momentary excursion into the arcane mysteries of modern analytic jurisprudence. Ed was kind enough to say that from time to time I write about the real world, but we're going to descend into the philosophy textbooks just for a moment. The account I'm giving focuses on the spirit or the heritage of the law. But in terms of the dominant jurisprudence, it's not always easy to sort of make sense of talk about the spirit of the law as opposed to the black letter of the law. It's often thought that legal positivism finds it difficult to say anything sensible about the spirit of the law for two connected reasons. It tends to view the law as just a heap or accumulates one damn thing after another. Yeah? It ignores or doesn't say nearly enough about system and structure, the interlocking character of many legal provisions, the way various rules and doctrines hang together. That's number one. And number two, it tends to just focus on the rules themselves, on the enacted texts themselves, rather than on sort of deeper principles and policies that might in some sense lie behind them and pervade them. That's will be familiar to many of you as the basis of Ronald Dworkin's early critique of legal positivism in Taking Rights Seriously. On Dworkin's account, law is not just a set of rules. There are also policies and principles which do their work behind the scenes, behind the legal rules, filling in gaps, helping us with hard cases, providing touchstones for legal argument, and capturing the underlying spirit of whole areas of doctrine. One of the claims that I want to make is that the prohibition on torture operates not just as a rule or a set of rules, but also like one of these background features that Dworkin identified. The first criticism is also important, that positivism doesn't give enough attention to structure, to the way that the rules hang together. A set of legal norms often work together to pursue a common value. The easiest example is the obvious one. you might have a statute with hundreds of separate provisions, but those separate provisions are supposed to act together to pursue a common purpose, the common purpose of the statute as a whole. A statute is not just a heap of little laws. It's supposed to operate as an integrated whole, and the purpose of the statute explains what is being aimed at and explains also how the enterprise of aiming at that goal is organized. That's an easy example. Slightly harder example requires us to look not just at the multiple provisions of one statute, but the way in which a plurality of statutes, an array of statutes, or an array of precedents, or an array of doctrines may work together to embody a common purpose or a legal policy. I mean, think of the way rules governing contract formation come together with rules about consideration, rules about duty, rules about breach, rules about damages and liability to add up to a more or less coherent package that, as it were, makes sense holistically, not just making sense in each one of its little pieces. Separate legal provisions interact to constitute a unified realm of legal meaning, a structured array with a distinctive spirit of its own. Now go back for a moment to the easy case of a single statute with lots of clauses. A statute operates as an integrated whole, I said, and the purpose of the whole explains, you know, how the particular pieces are supposed to work. Sometimes that purpose has to be inferred by people who read the statute. But sometimes it's explicit. Sometimes there's an explicit purpose clause or a preamble which tells you what the purpose is supposed to be. And I think the same is true in the slightly harder case when you're dealing with multiple laws, which are supposed to operate as an integrated whole with a unified point or purpose. Sometimes the purpose has to be inferred by the kind of interpretive reasoning that Dworkin talks about in his later work in Law's Empire and elsewhere. But sometimes, and this is where I go beyond Dworkin, there is one provision in the cluster, one provision in the array that stands out as sort of vividly epitomizing or expressing the spirit of the whole. It's rather like a purpose clause. It has its own work to do, but it's rather like a purpose clause for the larger array of laws. It becomes a sort of emblem or icon or token of the whole area of law. It becomes, I will say, an archetype of the spirit of the area of law in question. So that's the idea that I wanted to focus on and use with regard to torture. The term archetype, I didn't just make it up. It's used by John Locke, my favorite. It's used by Carl Jung. I'm not trying to use it in any sort of greatly philosophically loaded sense. When I use the term, I just mean a particular provision in a system of norms that kind of does double service. A particular provision in a system of norms which, number one, prohibits certain actions, establishes certain obligations or procedures. It does its own primary work, but it also does secondary work of sort of background organizing, expressive work, expressing the point of a whole area of law. So when I use the term archetype, I mean a particular provision in a system of norms which has a significance going beyond its immediate normative content, a significance stemming from the fact that it sums up or makes vivid to us the point, purpose, principle, or policy of a whole area of law. Like a Dworkinian principle, the archetype performs a background function in a given legal system, but archetypes differ from Dworkinian principles in that they also operate as foreground provisions. So it's the idea of this sort of dual service. Now, that's the idea that I'm going to use with regard to the rules about torture. I think that they have important work of their own to do, but they also have important expressive work with regard to some broader principle of policy, and I'll talk about that principle of policy in a moment. I just want to give you one or two other examples to help illustrate the idea. I think the habeas corpus statute, or the habeas corpus provisions, do enormously important work of their own. But they also have a significance that goes beyond that work as expressive of a general attitude in the law towards arbitrary detention or towards liberty. The second example is perhaps less reputable, but I mean, think of the Second Amendment, right? Actually, the direct normative work that it does is probably pretty limited. Second Amendment challenges to gun laws are often rejected. But nevertheless, it sums up a general attitude of permissiveness towards gun possession and permissiveness on issues of gun control that is distinctive of our legal system. And if you were to alter the Second Amendment, you wouldn't just be altering the rather minimal direct work that it does. You'd be changing, as it were, the spirit, in some sense, for many people at least, of the Constitution. The third example uses a precedent rather than a rule as an archetype. I think the most obvious example, Brown against the Board of Education. In terms of its direct commanding impact, its authority for a relatively narrow proposition about segregation in schools, and its immediate effect was notoriously slow and limited. But its archetypal power is staggering. And in the years since 1954, it has become an icon of the law's commitment to demolish the structures of segregation. So if anybody says now, of course schools are desegregated, but I think Brown was wrongly decided. If they say that during a Supreme Court confirmation hearing, they're dead. You can't say it, because it expresses something massively important with regard to anti-discrimination areas generally, not just this particular narrow proposition, which is the immediate effect of the precedent. I could give other examples, but let's move on. What is the rule about torture archetypal of? I mean, it has important work of its own to do that I've been talking about. I think it's archetypal of an important underlying principle in our law that looks something like the following. These are my formulations, not anybody else's. I call it the non-brutality principle. Law is not brutal in its operation, nor is it savage. It doesn't rule through the instrumentalization of abject fear and terror, or by breaking or smashing the will of those it confronts. If law is forceful, and it often has to be, if law is coercive, and it often has to be, then it gets its way by non-brutal methods of coercion, which respect rather than mutilate the dignity and agency of those who are its subjects. In other words, the idea is that even when law has to operate forcefully, it will not operate or countenance actions which are brutal. People may be deterred by legal sanctions, they may dread lawsuits, they may on occasion be literally forced against their will by legal means to do things or go places they would not otherwise do or go to. But even when this happens, the idea is that they will not be herded like cattle or broken like horses. They will not be beaten like dumb animals or treated just as bodies to be manipulated. Instead, there will be an enduring connection between the spirit of law, even the spirit of forceful law, and respect for human dignity. Respect for dignity even in extreme situations where law is at its most forceful and its subjects are at their most vulnerable. I believe the rule against torture does not only the very important particular work that it's required to do, but it also stands as a sort of emblem or archetype of this more general principle. It's vividly emblematic of our determination to break the link between law and brutality, between law and terror, between law and the enterprise of trying to smash a person's will. As I say, nobody denies that law has to get its way in the final analysis. Nobody denies that law has to be forceful. But forcefulness can take many forms, and not all of it involves a sort of savage breaking of the will and a regression of the subject into an infantile state of bestial terror that is the aim of torture and the aim, too, of many of the merely cruel and inhuman methods that some of our officials would like to distinguish from torture for the purpose of maintaining lip service to the prohibition. The force of ordinary legal sanctions doesn't work like that, nor does the literal force of physical control and confinement. For example, when a defendant is charged with a serious offense, when he's brought into the courtroom, he's brought in whether he likes it or not, and when he's punished, he's subject to penalties that he would definitely avoid if he could. But force and coercion do not work against him by reducing him to a quivering mass of terror. So when I say that the prohibition on torture is an archetype of this, I'm not looking to some sort of paradise of non-coercive. It's just that there are ways of coercing people legally in a legal system which don't involve this sort of assault on the basic dignity of their agency. that our law keeps perfect faith with this principle? Of course not. Right? Defendants are sometimes kept silent in American courtrooms by the use of technology which enables the judge to zap them with electric shocks if they misbehave. Reports of prisoners being herded with cattle prods emerge from time to time. Conditions in our prison are de facto terrorizing and are well known to be so, and even though this is officially disapproved, district attorneys use it all the time as bargaining leverage in plea bargaining. You know what goes on in these places? You really want to go there? They say. This can be conceded, but when it happens, it's a matter of shame, and it's not just a matter of moral shame, it's a matter of shame for the law itself in terms of its own heritage and its own principles. So the idea is that to criticize these practices, we don't need to step outside the legal realm. We can actually draw not only on our constitutional resources that uphold this principle, but on the deeper heritage of Anglo-American jurisprudence, which is committed to it. And I think the familiar prohibition on torture serves as an archetype of this principle. Can I just say something a little bit more detailed about how the principle on torture serves as an archetype of this principle? I have in mind a couple of areas. Forget about that. In Eighth Amendment jurisprudence, it has been said, I think correctly, that the original impetus for the constitutional prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment came from the framers' repugnance towards the use of torture, which was regarded as incompatible with the liberties of Englishmen. And this, the interesting thing is that even though torture is not officially used as a punishment, it continues to be a point of reference in our Eighth Amendment reasoning. Even for those sentenced to death, the court has held that punishments of torture and all others in the same line of unnecessary cruelty are forbidden. They use the prohibition on torture as a sort of reference point, which establishes a sort of a penumbra that we will work within. It's a sort of a guidance, like a lighthouse. You stay away from that and you stay well away from that. You stay away from torture and from other punishments in the same line of unnecessary cruelty. We see this in what has been said in our courts about officers' acquiescence in prison rape, about what the withholding of medical treatment from prisoners, about the use of corporal punishment in our prisons, which continued until relatively recently. The suggestion was never that corporal punishment was in itself equivalent to torture. The issue was that the very reasons that drive us away from torture require us to take a very hard look and skeptical look at corporal punishment, which indicates that the orientation towards the prohibition on torture is being used to sort of signal that there's a deeper principle doing the work here. Or think about some aspects of procedural due process, and particularly the law relating to self-incrimination. Reference to torture is common in the jurisprudence of due process and self-incrimination, not because we torture people for confessions anymore, but because we use our confidence that that would be wrong to understand our confidence that other things are wrong. So principles of procedural due process are expressed by saying things like the rack and the torture chamber may not be substituted for the witness stand. And the privilege against self-incrimination, we are told, was designed primarily to prevent a recurrence of the Inquisition. Here, as with the Eighth Amendment jurisprudence, the point is not to remind us that torture is prohibited, but to use our clear grip on that to illuminate and motivate other prohibitions that are perhaps less extreme, but pervasive and important in the ordinary life of the law. I have a quote there from, I don't know how to pronounce this, Roshan against California. It's a 1952 case. Some of you will be familiar with it. Narcotics detectives burst into a room and they see somebody's quickly swallowing something. So they direct a doctor to force an emetic solution into the stomach of the suspect against his will. He has to be held down, and tubes used or whatever. The suspect's vomiting brought up two morphine capsules, which he had swallowed when he first saw the detectives. The subject was convicted of unlawful possession of morphine. The Supreme Court reversed the conviction, holding that force so brutal and so offensive to human dignity was constitutionally prohibited. Justice Frankfurter said famously of Mr. Roshan's treatment, these are methods too close to the rack and the screw. Too close. Right? The rack and the screw, the prohibition on that is used as a point of reference, and then we move back from that. Referring to some earlier decisions prohibiting the use of coerced confessions, he more or less explicitly stated the non-brutality principle. He stated that these decisions are applications of a general principle that states and their prosecution and their prosecutions respect certain decencies of civilized conduct. To sanction the brutal conduct, which naturally enough was condemned by the court whose judgment is before us, to sanction that conduct would be to afford brutality the cloak of law. Nothing would be more calculated to discredit law and thereby to brutalize the temper of a society. Once again, you don't need, in order to grasp what's going on there, you don't need to say that the Supreme Court thought Mr. Roshan was being tortured in order to see how the prohibition on torture, the rack and the screw, is key to the Supreme Court's invocation of a more general non-brutality principle to condemn this novel form of coercion. And in recent years, the court has repeated this approach, again using language there that I've highlighted. This is the case of McCune against Lyle. Courts must decide when they're examining allegations of coerced confession whether the consequences of an inmate's choice to remain silent are closer to the physical torture against which the Constitution clearly protects or closer to the de minimis harms against which it does not. We use the prohibition on torture to anchor one end of the spectrum. And my guess is that to the extent that the prohibition on torture itself becomes shaky or uncertain as a legal standard, we lose our point of orientation for this sort of judgment. You know, we should all be trying to improve our vocabulary. So I want to introduce a new word, avulsive. I didn't make this up, but it's actually got it from a judgment of Justice Scalia in a different context altogether. It's, I think, basically a medical term. Avulsion literally means a forcible tearing of one body part from another. And so we distinguish between an avulsive change and a non-avulsive change. If you have one of those loose leaf folders, you know, that you click open the binding clips, and you carefully lift out one piece of paper and then click it shut again, you've taken out one piece of paper, so that's a difference. But you haven't done any damage to the rest of the papers in the folder. That's a sort of non-avulsive change. But if you tear some pages out of a paperback book, then you damage the binding and some of the other pages will fall out with it. And more comes out when you make this change. It would be like if I were to try and remove the pocket from this jacket. You know, I'm a bad tailor and a lot of material would come out if I attempted to do kidney surgery or something. Right? These would not be neat detachments. And the suggestion is that the removal or a change to the rules about torture, horrendous in themselves, also we need to understand that these are not neat detachments from the surrounding of law. They would take out some of the surrounding tissue with them. And that's what I've been talking about in this discussion. All right, we're almost at the end. I've said that the prohibition on torture is a legal archetype, which means that in some sense other law depends on its integrity. In what sense is this true? Is this an empirical prediction? I've spoken, you know, sort of use this fancy word avulsion and so on, but really isn't this a sort of a domino effect or a slippery slope argument, and maybe it should be treated with all the suspicion that slippery slope arguments usually deserve. Actually, it's not a slippery slope argument, it's a reverse slippery slope argument. In a slippery slope argument, the danger is that if you do some little bad thing, you'll end up sliding down so that you end up doing some very bad thing, right? You start doing a couple of little bad things and before you know it, you've slid down the slippery slope to do something truly awful. This is about reverse slippery slope. If you start with messing with the thing that actually prohibits you doing the thing that is truly awful, it'll be very hard, as it were, to prevent the rest of it crashing down on top of you. Right? So you're starting your messing at the bottom. But you don't realize how important it is that that bottom is secured by a prohibition of a certain sort. So I am arguing that if we mess with the prohibition on torture, we may find it harder to defend some of the arguably less extreme requirements, but still important requirements, that are perched above torture on the slippery slope. Our belief that flogging in prisons is wrong, that coerced confessions are wrong, that pumping a person's stomach for narcotics is wrong, that police brutality generally is wrong. These beliefs may each of them be uncertain and a little shaky, but the confidence that we have in them, such as it is, depends partly on analogies we have constructed between them and torture. Not arguing that they are torture, but that they are uncomfortably like torture. If we undermine the sense that torture is absolutely out of the question, then we lose a crucial point of reference for sustaining these other, perhaps somewhat less confident, beliefs. Remember, we're dealing here with law, not just with our own reasoning. We're dealing here with law that is a reasoning that we share in common with large numbers of others. And above all, we are dealing here with reasoning, with argumentation. My position assumes that argument is not just decoration in the law, but a medium through which legal positions are sustained and elaborated. It assumes that whether a given argument works about flogging in prisons or stomach pumping for narcotics, whether a given argument works depends on what decisions have already been made and upheld in the law. You see, in constitutional law, we don't just argue pragmatically for what we think is the best result. We argue all the time by analogy with results already established, or we argue for general propositions on the basis of decisions that already appear to embody them. And it's that fact about argument that indicates what may be in danger here. There's also a more qualitative concern. But I think what I've just said is an empirical hypothesis, and so it is subject to empirical refutation. If it turned out that a society like ours could torture detainees but still maintain the integrity of its own constitutional law at home, I would be surprised, but I would be refuted in this account. But in addition to that, there's a general sort of point, a qualitative point about corruption. Here's an analogy with an individual. Suppose somebody, a lawmaker or an official of some sort, municipal official, decides that he will accept bribes and kickbacks. He will do that. He's been attracted by the money. But he wants to maintain honesty, and he resolves that despite this, he will nevertheless remain honest in other areas of his personal and professional life and not steal things or cheat on his taxes or do anything like that. So he wants to maintain a sort of firewall between one sort of dishonesty and another. Right? He'll go this far, but no further. I think the cost there is that firewall has to be maintained artificially. He no longer refrains from stealing for the reasons that are common to the condemnation of stealing and bribery. Right? If he refrains from stealing, if he has to try and figure out whether something would be too close to stealing, he no longer has that resource to use in his reasoning, right? So he's trying to figure out whether you're allowed to take, I don't know, pencils home to your children from the office. And he no longer has, as it were, the common principle that would unite the prohibition on bribery with the prohibition on theft to figure out that hard case. He has to try and do it in terms of the puny, thin artifice of his own determination that his vice will go thus far and no further. That, I think, is a moral loss attendant on his corruption. And I think the damage done to our system of law by undermining the prohibitions on torture is just like this. If we permit the torture of Al-Qaeda, Taliban, and Iraqi insurgent detainees, or if we define what most of us regard as torture as not really torture at all, or if we set up a Dershowitz-style regime of judicial torture warrants, maybe only a few people, maybe only a few hundred people, will be affected, harmed, in the first instance. But the character of our legal system would be corrupted. We would be moving from a situation in which our law had a certain character that it prided itself on, a general virtue of non-brutality, to a situation in which that character would be compromised by the permitting of this most brutal of practices. We would have given up the linchpin of this principle that law will not operate savagely or countenance brutality, and we'd no longer be able to state that doctrine in any categorical form. instead would have to say something sort of equivocal like the following. Well, it's a difficult matter. You know, in most cases, it's true the law will not permit or countenance brutality. But since torture is now permitted in a hopefully small and carefully cabined class of cases, we cannot rule out the possibility that in other cases the use of brutal tactics will also be permitted by analogy, and so on. In other words, the repudiation of brutality would become a technical matter, which you had to look up, rather than a shining issue of principle for the law. And I think that would be a massive cost. So that's what I'm saying. We use the prohibition on torture as an archetype. And in order to see what might go wrong as a result of undermining this prohibition, we have to, I don't know, imagine Eighth Amendment jurisprudence without this point of reference, arguing about cruelty without the assumption that torture, at any rate, is wholly out of the question. We have to imagine Fifth Amendment jurisprudence without this point of reference. We have to imagine arguing about coerced confessions and self-incrimination against the background of an assumption that torture is sometimes legally permissible. The halting and hesitant character of such argumentation would itself be a blight on our law, in addition to the direct abuses that resulted. Okay, so that's it. There are all sorts of reasons, of course, to be concerned about torture. And these reasons are important, but they're not the most important. The most important issue about torture remains the action itself and the quality of the prohibition against it. The most important issue in my mind remains the issue of moral absolutes, the categorical and uncompromising rule against the instrumentalization of pain and terror. The issue of the relation between that rule and the rest of the law is kind of a second-tier issue, and this has been second-tier work. It's not primary work on why torture is wrong. It's a sort of a second-tier issue, but it's important nevertheless. It's like discussions, which are also important, about our proven inability to keep torture under control if we ever permit it. Our proven inability to insulate it against the sort of depravity we saw at Abu Ghraib. The fatuousness of the suggestion made by Professor Dershowitz and Charles Krauthammer and others that we could confine its application to exactly the cases which a philosopher might think it is justified. Those are all second-tier issues as well, and they are important. They're sort of moral pragmatics, if you like, and this is some sense of legal systematics in relation to these issues. But even though it's not the most important thing, I have found that this second-tier thinking about archetypes is useful in my general thinking about law. I found it helpful as a way of figuring out what it is for law to structure itself, what it is for law to present itself in a certain light. I found it helpful to think about archetypes as a general issue in political philosophy, as a corrective to some of the simplicities of legal positivism, and as an interesting elaboration of Ronald Dworkin's jurisprudence. Most of all, I found this exploration helpful in understanding what the prohibition on torture symbolizes. By thinking about the prohibition not just as a rule but as an archetype, I think we can reach a clearer and more substantive sense of what we aspire to in our jurisprudence, namely a body of law, a rule of law, that renounces savagery, and a state that pursues its purposes, even its most urgent purposes, and secures its subjects, even its most endangered subjects, and fights its enemies, even its most violent and vicious enemies, honorably and without recourse to brutality and terror. Thank you very much indeed.